I was interested this morning in how many times we use the word Father in our announcements and in our songs and in our prayers and in our Bible study. And again this evening, I don't know whether you were sensitized to that as I was by the fact that today is Father's Day, but that is the occasion, and it is not a religious occasion, of course. But I tried when we talked about Mother's Day not too long ago to say, there's some reasons why we might want to consider this topic in our Bible study together. I don't really feel compelled to make that argument when we talk about fathers, because clearly fathers is a biblical topic. And you don't have to go very far in the reading of the Scriptures, certainly in the New Testament, before you encounter that idea. So I want us to consider this evening something about fatherhood and about fathers, not so much about the Father's Day that we're celebrating. In 1936, we officially established third Sunday in June as Father's Day, 22 years after we had established the Mother's Day kind of a holiday. But I think there probably has never been more important time for emphasizing the need for fathers and the role of fathers in society than at this particular time in our country's history. We have arrived at a point in which we really don't understand what fathers are, what their role is, nor even really the importance of fathers. And, you know, it's kind of interesting in some ways in terms of popular culture about how these ideas come and go. From my generation, I thought about these TV fathers. Some of you would know Jim Anderson of Father Knows Best, or Heathcliff Huxtable. Many of you would know him, or Howard Cunningham from Happy Days, or Ward Cleaver, the quintessential, perhaps, television father. Ben Cartwright and Andy Taylor, who had the difficult role of being a single parent fathers. Those are ideas, I think, that probably aren't too prevalent on television anymore, because they are ideas that we find we've passed by, perhaps, a little bit. I want to talk some about fathers, and I am reminded when I think about that of the occasion when I was at a congregation a number of years ago, and I preached on Mother's Day, and everybody was, you know, all sentimental about that. And then Father's Day was coming up, and they said, "Now you're going to talk about fathers." And Wanda overheard the conversation. She said, "Now be careful what you ask for, because it's not the same kind of sermon when he preaches about fathers." Fatherhood is not quite the sentimental sort of thing, perhaps, that Mother's Day is, and there's a reason for that, and we think about it differently, perhaps, than we do about mothers and about Mother's Day. I really want to emphasize this evening about the idea of the responsibility of fatherhood, and I want to admonish those of us who are fathers or who will be fathers to take seriously that responsibility, and I want to conclude, of course, by considering a little bit what we learn about fatherhood from our Father who is in heaven, and the kind of praise and the kind of thanksgiving that we all owe to Him for what He has done for us. Think about what a father is, and you know, it's interesting with the internet available that people post all sorts of questions on Yahoo Question. They said, "What is a father?" And of course, they get a whole bunch of short, clever answers. You know, he is the biological father, the sire, the sperm donor kind of a thing. Clearly, that's not significant or serious even when we think about what a father is. I think, of course, that there's nothing so helpless as a newborn child, and probably a mother of a nursing child is in need of protection too. And that, I think, is the start of what we need in terms of fatherhood in society, that there is this need for someone to take the responsibility for that family. And fatherhood begins in that responsibility, not so much in the biology of reproduction, but in that responsibility, and then it grows and increases even beyond that. What exactly is a father? We have a great deal more sense about what a mother is. We don't even think about asking that question, but what exactly is a father? Someone has said about a father that he is someone who plays catch with you. He is someone who will catch you before you fall. He is someone who will pick you up after you have fallen. He is someone who wants to keep you from making mistakes, but instead he lets you find your own way. Irma Bombeck said, fathers are no different than mothers. They just watch their kids fall off the tricycle and help them get back on again. Fathers are the kind who read the newspaper while their child is practicing parallel parking for the first time. Fathers are a little bit different than mothers in that sense. Father, Frank A. Clark said, is a man who expects his son to be as good a man as he meant to be when he was growing up. There's a sense in which there is that kind of a relationship between a man and his children. There's a sense, too, in which we wonder a little bit about this kind of lack of sentimentality, perhaps, associated with Father's Day. On Mother's Day, of course, the florists are busy. Not so on Father's Day. On Mother's Day, the telephone truck lines are overloaded and the wireless, you know, interferes with one another. But not so much on Father's Day. There is something that's not quite so sentimental about that kind of a relationship. There is a difference in some ways between motherhood and fatherhood, a difference in that kind of relationship. Father's Day is less sentimental because fathers are less sentimental than mothers are. Fathers are less sentimental because the need of fatherhood is not so much for sentiment as it is for determination and persistence. Providing requires not less love, but it does require less sentiment and more resolve than the issue of nurturing as mothers nurture their children. Not less important, but certainly of a different nature and a different texture. One of the problems, of course, in America today is the problem of fatherlessness, which I think is related to this idea that there's less sentimentality about fatherhood than there is about motherhood. It requires a determination, a will, a constancy, and a commitment that is not so much in keeping with the tenor of our time as perhaps the sentimentality, the kind of nurturing love of motherhood might well be. And as a result, we have a crisis of fathers in our society. Over half of all children in America will live some of their years before 18 without a father in the house. Only 25% of children in America will live with their biological fathers until they're 18 years old. And you see the result of that, I think, in so many ways. I've been captured watching the NBA Finals here the past couple of weeks by the their public service announcements, where they show the poor little kids pathetically going out trying to set up a dummy to play catch with them because they have no father who will fill that role with them. Unfortunately, of course, there are other negative and insidious influences here, too, not just the fact that fathers have abandoned their children, but also the fact that our society seems to encourage that sort of an idea with a negative attitude toward fatherhood in general. That is a denigration of fatherhood. It began, of course, with the feminists who were suspicious of the traditional family kind of package in which the father was the provider, the protector, the head, and the authority of the home. And they have kind of gotten to the point where not only are they suspicious of that, they're suspicious of the influence of fathers altogether on the lives of their children. And they have confused the whole issue about male-female roles to the point that they suppose that they are interchangeable in some ways, and not only interchangeable, that a woman can, in fact, take care of her children by herself. And we end up then with many women who do take care of children by themselves. Not to say that in some cases they don't do a tremendous and heroic job of doing that, but that's not what God intended. And I think most of those mothers would say to you, if you ask them, it's not best, that it takes an extra effort and an extra determination to try and do both of those things. And that's not what God intended at all. And on the other side, you see a denigration in some ways of the stereotypical sort of father. You know, they laugh in the news and the media and on TV and in the movies about the standard kind of father who plays with his children, who watches sports on TV, who maybe is a little bit overweight, is his belly hangs over his belt, perhaps, and he belches when he watches the sports games. I'll tell you something about that, though. The boys who grow up in households with those kind of fathers, whatever you may think about them, are not going to end up going to prison because they commit crimes. There's a value to fathers that our society has overlooked. And it's kind of difficult, perhaps, for us to get our minds around why that's important if we're not Christians and don't read the Bible. But our society seems to have neglected and misunderstands that altogether. There's a valuable contribution that fathers, even those kind of stereotypical sort of fathers, and you look and you say, what in the world does that father do? I don't know what he does, but somehow he has a powerful impact on his children. Fathers give to their children a sense of self-esteem that they can't get just from their mothers. They give to their children a sense of empathy for other people that they don't get just from their mothers. They make a valuable contribution over and beyond that which people think. Irma Bombeck, in the article I mentioned earlier, received a letter from a reader, and the reader said, I raised my son by myself, and now he's about to be a father, and he wants to know what fathers are supposed to do. What should I tell him? And Irma Bombeck said, well, I lost my father at 9 years of age, and I was a little puzzled about that, too. I thought fathers, they bring the car around when it's raining so nobody else gets wet. And I thought fathers, they're the ones that take the pictures, and that's why they're never in the pictures. And they carve the turkey. And fathers, of course, they end up mowing the grass. And they're the ones who go down to the basement because they're not afraid to go down there and the spiders and the dust and everything. But what did fathers do? And she said, when I got married and I ended up with a children and with a husband and father of my children, I was still a little puzzled about what does he do? Why do they like him so much? He doesn't spend a whole lot of time taking care of them and feeding them. He does nothing about their saggy, baggy diapers. And yet they love and admire him and they go rushing to see him. What exactly is it that he does that makes him so important in their lives? She couldn't quite figure that out. But I think she finally did. Let me just pull that out and see exactly the way she said that when she kindly came to a conclusion about that. He threw them higher than his head till they were weak from laughter. Well, that's not so good. He cast the deciding vote on the puppy debate. He listened more than he talked. He let them make mistakes. He allowed them to fall from their two-wheeler without having a heart attack. If I had to tell someone's son what a father really does that is important, it would be that he shows up for the job in good times and bad times. He's a man who's constantly being observed by his children. They learn from him how to handle adversity, anger, disappointment, and success. He will dig out at 1 a.m. when one of his children runs out of gas. He will make unpopular decisions and stand by them. He sets the tone on how family members treat one another, on how they treat the opposite sex, and how they treat people who are different than they are. But mostly, a good father involves himself in his kids' lives. There's something to be said about fatherhood that our society has overlooked. It clearly is critically important. The Bible talks about fathers a whole lot more than it talks about mothers. 1,718 times, aren't computer concordance is wonderful. 1,718 times the Bible mentions the word father or fathers, and only 378 times does it mention the word mother or mothers. Not to denigrate the importance of mothers, we certainly don't want to make that mistake, but the role of the father is critically important. And it is something that the Bible talks about a great deal and that we ought to take seriously. There's not only the problem of fathers who are absent from the home altogether and who've absented themselves from the lives of their children. And I'll tell you, this is something that aggravates me to no end, to see a man who has fathered children to walk out on them, whatever the circumstances. There's a certain component of our culture where the young boys grow up thinking that that's what they're supposed to do, and that's the way in which they get their status, is by fathering children here, there, and elsewhere, and never taking any responsibility for them. Well, that's reprehensible. I don't know what those guys are thinking. But just as reprehensible to me are those guys that get married and they have children, and then because they don't like the mother or they wish they had another wife or because it's too much for them, they walk out on those children. Reprehensible altogether. And I think we all recognize and agree with that. But there is the sense, too, in which fathers are absent because they are there in the home, but they really don't involve themselves in their children's lives, that they are not what they ought to be in the home with their children. A recent Gallup poll suggested that over 50% of people in America agreed that their fathers spend less time with the children than their father spent with them. Some of these were fathers who said, I spend less time with my children than my father spent with me. But do you know what's interesting about that? That's the second generation in which that's been true. If in each generation we cut in half the amount of time that fathers are spending with their children, then where are we going to end up? We talked about Zeno's paradox last week, and the idea you cut it in half and you don't ever quite get there, but you keep cutting it in half and pretty soon it's minimal and really unimportant. One of the things, of course, that is devastating to family time together in general, but certainly to fathers spending time with their children, is the idea of television and computers. Children between the ages 2 and 12 spend about 12 minutes a day with their fathers. We talk about 12-minute dads. You know, there's the one-minute manager, the 12-minute manager, or whatever that book was. 12-minute dads don't quite get it done. That's compared to the fact that they spend about 3 hours a day with television and 2.5 hours a day on non-schoolwork kind of computer use. There's a whole lot greater influence there in the TV and in the computer than there is in the father's time that he spends with his children. How much time do fathers spend with their children? Well, there are a lot of different ways in which they spend time with their children, not just in terms of direct conversation, but doing things together or just being in the house where the children can see what they do and how they conduct themselves. Some fathers, of course, think that they can substitute presence for presence in the household, that they have mistaken what the values of a family ought to be, and they spend all their time working, maybe more than they need to, in order to buy their kids things, when what their kids really want is to spend time with their children. Children don't see the world in the same way that adults do. They don't have the same needs that adults have. And fathers need to know what their view of the world is and what their needs really are, because that's what they're responsible for, providing for those children. C.S. Lewis said that time spent with a child is never wasted. Of course, that's an interesting kind of question to consider. Do children remember the things that their parents do with them? Wanda just recently discovered that maybe they don't remember things the way that you want them to or you thought they would. She was asking one of them about this special theme birthday party she'd provided for him, and he had no recollection of it whatsoever, hours and hours of work. And so then she started exploring that, and I said, don't be asking any more questions. You might not want the answers. But she started exploring that. You know, there are a lot of things you thought this is going to be special for the child, and they're not going to remember it. They remember things in a different way than we intend for them to. They remember the little things, the unusual things. They remember the time that we rode all across town to find a special hot dog. They remember the time that we dug a hole in the yard just as deep as we could to see how the color of the dirt changed. They remember things like that that you never intended would be the special occasions of their life. The time you spend with them is not wasted. Of course, I've told you the story before about Brooke Adams, the U.S. ambassador to Britain, an important, influential man, an essayist and a diarist, and how his son followed his example. There you have it again, way children see things, and started his own diary. And you look at the parallel records, and on the one day, his son writes in his diary, I went fishing with my dad. It was the best day of my life. In Brooke's diary, it says, went fishing with my son, a wasted day. No time with a child is really ever wasted. Father went into a conference with the principal about his son, and his principal, you know, had talked to him before, and the son was constantly in trouble, and, you know, the father says, what am I going to do about this boy? What can I do about this boy? And the principal asked him, well, what do you do with your time? And he knew that he was a member of all of these clubs and he was a president of a company and that he spent his time in volunteer activities, spent his time in recreational activities with his buddies. And he said, I'll tell you what you need to do. You need to give up being the president of this club you are and spend that time with your son. That's what you need to do in order to straighten out your son. Spend time with him. You know, it is in some ways true. Almost any man can be a father a child. But being a father is one of life's great privileges and great responsibilities. It is a trust of eternity. Because the truth of the matter is that fathers are responsible for the eternal souls of their children. And maybe even of their wives. You know, you take on a great responsibility when you marry, and an even greater responsibility when you have children. And there is a responsibility not just for this world, but for the world to come. It's interesting to think about Noah, who was called by God to build an ark in which he would save his family. And of Noah, you can say at least this, he saved his family. That's more than you can say for some of the other great men of the Bible. But in a sense, every man is an ark builder who is trying to save the souls of his family, his wife, and his children. We have to keep in mind as fathers, as Christian fathers, what the end result is that we're looking for, not as the world sees it, but in the way in which the Bible wants us to see it. You know, today we talk about raising children at our peril, because the world doesn't like that idea of raising children. You know, it's a peculiar, somebody was asking me this the other day about the liberal mindset. Well, I said that, the liberal mindset. They said, what exactly is that? And I said, well, you know, it's kind of an inconsistency as far as I can penetrate into it. You know, they never are pinned down because they don't have any absolute principles by which to make determinations. And consequently, they can take any side of any issue at any point in time. They just don't understand about, you know, issues like raising children. And the reason that occurs to me at this point is because, on the one hand, liberals don't want anything to do with individual responsibility. What you are is a consequence of society. But on the other hand, when you start talking about raising children, that makes them nervous too, because, you know, they think maybe somehow the children are what they make their own choices about what they're going to be, and parents and fathers in particular aren't responsible for that. Now, that's kind of inconsistent to me. Yes, there is individual responsibility, but there's a responsibility of fatherhood too, because children, when they're young, are malleable and they can be shaped, and that's the responsibility that God's given to to people who are fathers. Raise up your children in the way they should go, and when they're old, they'll not depart from it. A father is responsible for his children and for their behavior. They tried to pass that law in California a few years ago. They've gone in the opposite direction now in California, liberal mindset. But they tried to pass that law a few years ago that when children committed crimes, that the parents were responsible for it. They had to make financial recompense for what their children had done. And, of course, any father worth his worth the name of being a father would take responsibility for that. We are responsible for what our children are and what they become in the world. We need to be concerned about that. Edgar Guest put it this way: if I don't help my boy Bud to grow up right, I'll call myself a failure. No matter how much money I make or how big a reputation I get, I have a number of tasks to do, all of which I should like to do well. To be a failure in any one of them would be a disappointment. Yet I could bear that without whimpering if I were sure I had not failed the boy. Not so much of me in the bank and more of me and of my best in the lad is what I should like to have to show at the end of my career. For me to succeed as a father, he must succeed. Unless my boy comes to manhood fit for the respect of his fellow man, I shall have been a failure. The glory of our handiwork lies not in ourselves, but in our children. What is the important thing that you want to do? Someone said about his son, I said, you know, he is making his mark in the world. And you want to know which world is he making a mark in, and in what way is he making a mark in the world? What do you want most out of life? As a father, you want your children to be what they ought to be. One of the boys called me and said, well, I was going to get you a present, but I didn't know what I should get you. I said, well, there's only one thing that a father wants for Father's Day. And some of you probably tried to consider this too. Send him a card. You know, you could buy things with the Hallmark kind of doggerel poetry in it, perhaps. That's all nice. You know, you might buy some kind of memento that has personal significance, a Florida State T-shirt. You might try and buy something that is real valuable. You know, you could get him a GPS, or maybe you really want to impress him. You know, you could buy him a plasma screen TV, you know, and help him install it, and then help him watch the sports on it. But there's only one thing fathers want, and that's for their children to be what they ought to be. That's the thing that defines what a father is. The Bible talks about that. It talks about what the attributes of a father are supposed to be. In Ephesians 6, verse 4, the passage that was read to you, suggests that fathers are to bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that they're not to provoke them to wrath. They're conducting themselves in such a way as to maintain in their children a kind of equal enmity so that they grow up wholesome and healthy, and that they grow up in the nurture of the Lord. Fathers are not really supposed to be just friends with their children. It's one of the peculiar ideas that we've adapted in the world today, that parents and children are supposed to be best friends. And maybe, you know, it's not just a thing to be bragging about. I don't think any of my children would say that I'm their best friend. I haven't aimed for that. And that's not really what the Bible talks about, is a parent's responsibility. I have read this letter from Ricardo Montalban a number of times. His son, whether you know it has any significance to you, Ricardo Montalban or not, I don't know. But here's a man who seems to understand this idea, that his role as a father is not to be a friend to his son. He writes this letter: "Dear son, as long as you live in this house, you will obey the rules. When you have your own house, you can make your own rules. In this house, we do not have a democracy. I did not campaign to be your father, and you didn't vote for me." Lots of children have said that to their fathers at some point in time. "I didn't choose you," but it doesn't matter. "We are father and son," he goes on to say, "by the grace of God, and I accept the privilege and the awesome responsibility. In accepting it, I have an obligation to perform the role of a father. I am not your pal. Our ages are too different. We can share many things, but we're not pals. I am your father, and that's 100 times what a pal will ever be. I'm also your friend, but we are on entirely different levels. You will do in this house as I say, and you cannot question me, because whatever I ask you to do is motivated by love. This will be hard for you to understand until you have a son of your own. Until then, trust me, your father." Indeed, I think he understands that difference that so many in our society have not understood. Children need a father a whole lot more than they need another friend among many friends. And it is the father's responsibility, I think, to set that kind of tenor for the house. Even Irma Bombeck, in her kind of humorous way, recognized that father's the one who settles the puppy debate. And what he says is what finally goes. There has to be in every household someone who finally, you know, makes the decision, who decides which direction the family's going to go. And God's given that responsibility to the father. You see too many democracies, you see too many kind of democratically run clubs or organizations that fall apart or spin their wheels, are ineffectual for exactly that reason. Because everybody has a vote and nobody ever gets to decide, and they can't decide. God saw that that shouldn't happen in the family, and he said the father would be the head and the father would make those decisions. And God helped those of us who are fathers to make the right decisions in all of those cases. Won't always make all the right decisions, but that's the role that the father has been assigned, and that's the role that he needs to fulfill. And of course, the father is in charge of discipline in the family. I think that's part of what's under consideration in Ephesians chapter 6 when he says, don't provoke your children to wrath. You know, one of the things that most angers us in life, and probably most angers children, is unfairness or inconsistency. The Bible, of course, suggests that fathers are supposed to discipline their children, but they discipline their children out of love. Hebrews chapter 12 is an interesting passage in the Bible that's talking to Christians who are in danger of losing their faith and returning to Judaism. And in that passage, God uses, as he does frequently in the Scriptures, the father-son relationship to explain how he deals with them. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you're illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, of course, he goes on to say, no chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful, but it yields afterwards the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who've been trained by it. And so it is that fathers owe discipline to their children, but discipline that emerges out of love. And I'd say this too. Children require and need consistency and constancy in their lives. There is a sense in which maybe that's one of the most important things from my point of view that children need. They need to know that their life is bounded about, that there are room to move about within these boundaries, but that they are protected and hedged about, not just by walls and not just by rules, but they're hedged and protected about by love. Childhood is a time that is filled with insecurities and inconsistencies as they're changing every day and as the world around them, changes from their perspective. It's interesting to talk to children and find out the things that they are afraid of, the things that disturb them in their life. And it is a world that I don't want to go back and live in again. You know, most of us as adults have only vaguely a memory of being children, about being afraid of the things under the bed, about, being afraid because we saw what happened to one of our friends at school, that the same thing is somehow going to happen to us. When we hear that, one of our schoolmates' parents have died, or worse than that, maybe even worse than that, there's been divorce, and they've, children think, could that happen to me? They need consistency and security in their life. That's what fathers need to provide for their children. Let them know that what is happening to them here and now is something that you are, of course, to the best of your ability. God doesn't always grant us the things that we want, that you're going to make that happen to them. You're going to keep that place secure for them. You're going to keep them secure. You know, it's amazing to me that we used to debate whether or not it was good for children to be taken off of the breast by the time they were two or 9 months, or whatever. Now we don't even worry about that. Now we just send them off to daycare at 3 months old. You know, can you imagine children of that age who don't have the constantly and consistency of a house and parents who are there for them and with them, and they send them off to daycare? You know, turnover rate among daycare workers, 40%. You know, they get attached to some daycare worker and they're gone. You know, the next week, somebody else shows up to take care of them. Children need the kind of constancy and the kind of security that parents can decide for them. You know, one of the other interesting things about that is that parents in modern times have decided that maybe it's okay if they don't spend much time with their children. They just spend quality time with their children. They want to make it real special time with their children. And, of course, there's an interesting thing. Special time in the sense of, let's see, I've worked 10 hours today. The children have been in daycare for 8 or 9 of those hours, and now I come home and I'm going to spend quality special time with the child. Yeah, let's see, between paying the bills, between taking care of the household chores, and just trying to regenerate myself, I'm going to spend special quality time with the child. I don't know. And then the other thing is the child going to think it's quality time? Let's make a date, you know, with a child and say at, 7:30 on Friday evening, we're going to spend some time together. It may fit their schedule and it may not fit their schedule. They may have a toothache and they may not have a toothache. They may be interested in what you planned and they may not be. Adults, of course, can make those kinds of arrangements. I doubt seriously that young children can make those kinds of arrangements. And remember, poor Wanda's experience, you make the special occasion for them, they may or may not remember that. What children need is they need a lot of time. And out of all that lot of time, some of it will be real special quality time to them and they'll remember it, but it may not necessarily be the time that you expected it to be or the time that you thought was going to be the quality time. We have a responsibility, as fathers most of all, to provide children with the right kind of example. How many times in the Old Testament does it say about those kings, they walked in the way of the father? The example that fathers provide for their children probably is the most powerful way in which they teach. Boy with clenched teeth is saying, I am not going to take that anymore. And the father says, I don't know where he gets it. The example is powerful in teaching children. I tell you what, I learned more about myself by having children than I ever really wanted to know. You know, it's like looking in the mirror, unfortunately, sometimes. They pick up the least kind of habits. And more important than that, they pick up the kind of character and attitude that their parents have. My dad used to say, it's a mighty poor man who can't raise a boy to be better than he is. And I've perhaps parroted that phrase over the years myself. And we may wish that our children could rise above our example and be better than we are, but that's taking a significant risk because mostly they're going to learn from our example. Denton said the most important issue for a man is not whether he's in charge of his family, but whether he's in charge of himself. And, of course, you really can't be in charge of a family unless you're in charge of yourself. And you may practice and you may preach to the children, especially, do what I say and not what I do, but that's unlikely to happen. The best way to ensure that children are going to be what they ought to be is that we are what we ought to be. It's often been said that children love their mother, but they follow their fathers, particularly probably true of boys. Our traditional nuclear family, the Bible-described kind of family, puts the father at the center of the family, at the center of the authority of the family, and for good reason. That father is going to have an enormous influence on those children. Even today, we think that's not the case, but it certainly is. A recent book about teenage rebellion asked the question of a lot of teenagers, who's had the most influence on you and who you are? And good fathers or bad fathers, the majority of them said it was their father who had the most influence on them. Fathers have that position of responsibility, and they need to be very careful about how they exercise that example. All of this, of course, embedded in the teaching of the Bible that God is our Father in heaven. That God is our Father is clearly specified in the New Testament. In particular, 11 times in the New Testament, we read specifically the phrase, God our Father. Even in the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples to pray, we're taught to pray, our Father who is in heaven. We have done that this day in every prayer that we have prayed, as we ought to do. In John 20 and verse 17, Jesus says, "Don't cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." God is our Father. And we learn about our relationship to Him by learning about fathers. Makes you kind of wonder, makes you feel a little nervous, perhaps, as a father, to think that children are going to grow up and their idea about God is going to be shaped by their idea and understanding of you and how you've conducted yourself. Luke 11, verses 10 through 13, Jesus significantly there says, if you want to know about Father, about God as a Father in heaven, then you need to look at your own fathers. Luke 11 and verse 10, for everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks will find, and to him who knocks it will be open. If a son asks for bread from his father among you, will he give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent instead of a fish? Or if he asks for an egg, will he give him a scorpion? Well, and of course, all those rhetorical questions are, of course not. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give His Holy Spirit to those who ask Him? And in Romans 8 and verse 15, He says those who receive the Spirit will be able to cry out to God, Abba, Father, our Father who is in heaven. A close personal relationship with our Father. A dependence upon His care and His concern and His constancy. Because we know that He seeks what is in our own best interest. And we also learn about our role as fathers in this life from how God the Father in heaven has treated us. Probably most of all from that example of all examples, John 3, verse 16, for God so loved the world that He sent His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. God our Father in heaven paid the ultimate father's price by sending His only begotten Son and sacrificing Him on our behalf that we might be His sons, that we might be a part of His family. What a standard God sets for fathers in this world. There is in this kind of love that God has for us and the kind of love that He wants fathers to have for their families, for their children, not necessarily the soft, nurturing kind of love of mother, but the strong and the resolute and the inexorable love of a father who, having put his hand to the family plow, plows on regardless of the weather or regardless of fatigue or regardless of the vagaries of the society around about him, regardless of the temptations of the world or those who offer some better plan, regardless of the goals that the world may set to him for this or that other ambition of his life, he inexorably does what is best for his family, for his children. That's the kind of father that we have in heaven, and that's the kind of father that he calls us to be. Those of us who will be privileged and have been privileged to be fathers. Not an easy task, and yet one that is filled with reward, especially when we look at our children and see what they're doing and what they've accomplished in life. And especially if we can keep them safe from the evil one and share heaven with our heavenly Father with them when this life is over. And of course, as we think about the role of fathers here in this world, we recognize that this world is not our home, that the families that we have here, filled with blessings as they are not the real family of which we are a member and which we will be a member through all of eternity, and even that the fathers that we have here in this life, whatever we may owe them and however kind they may have been to us and however much benefit they have done for us, are just a pale imitation of the Father who is in heaven, who has done so much for us and wants to do so much more for us, and with whom, if we give Him our lives here, we will spend all of eternity. If you have not made God in heaven your Father through the blood of Jesus Christ, His only begotten Son who died on the cross for us all, then that's the most important issue, unresolved issue in your life. And if you have, and you call Him Father in your prayers, then be thankful and grateful, not just on this Father's Day, but on every day. And not only be grateful, but give Him your life and live to be the kind of person that he wants you to be. If you're subject to the invitation of Jesus this evening, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing this song.